And good morning, everyone, and welcome once again to The Other Side of Midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. I'm your host. And this morning we have a really remarkable show. In fact, it couldn't have been better if I'd planned it, which we kind of tried to do. Before we get to our guest and the topic of this evening, I want to mention one thing. I've had a lot of emails, people wanting to know, what'd you think of The Martian? And I've got to make a very honest confession because of some developments that occurred over the weekend. Robin and I did not get to see The Martian. Ross, our producer, did not get to see The Martian, so we don't know actually what The Martian looks like in terms of the big screen. I've been looking at reviews. I know that it made something like $55 million in its first weekend. I know that Chris Matthews, who is on MSNBC and is a well-known political commentator and reporter, was gushing about it tonight and talking about it as the best of humanity and a human story, and you can't miss. Chris is a movie fan, so it's kind of interesting that he would so be taken by Ridley Scott's latest effort. As you know, we talked to Andy Weir on Saturday morning and got some backstory on the making of the film and the book and how they wove together, and obviously enough people went to see it. So Andy is not sad, as he said he would be if everybody didn't go and see it. But I have not seen it yet, nor has Ross, so I can't actually comment specifically. So we will save that commentary and that analysis for another night, and we will move on to the topic of our evening discussion. However, before we do that, I do want to make one mention. There's a very curious connection between the subject we're going to talk about tonight and what we talked about midweek last week, which was the work going on the EM drive by Dave Distler. I certainly want to applaud everyone who is supporting Dave's project, the Enterprise Project. If you go to Radio with Pictures tonight, remember, you go to othersideofmidnight.com. You click on tonight's guest, that takes you to the guest page, and at the top of the guest page, there is a section called Radio with Pictures, and you will see two links there. The first one is how you can support Dave's creation of a genuine, non-reaction space drive propulsion system called the EM drive. As we discussed last week, he's getting really remarkable developments. He's getting really remarkable data, and that data seems to be definitely trending in the direction that he's actually developing something which could, with a little more work and a little more engineering, might actually give us something which could take us anywhere in the solar system with literally zero fuel. Now, if you click on tonight's link, the first one, that's how you can support Dave's project. This connects very much to the subject of our first part of the evening, because our guest is going to be talking about something called the Utah Airship Mystery from the early 1900s, the era around 1917, 1918, when something that apparently could defy gravity was not an aircraft, was not a lighter-than-aircraft, was not an airship, was not a, you know, a balloon or a dirigible or something like the Hindenburg, but genuinely seemed to bespeak of some kind of unusual technology, was seen over the state of Utah for months and months and months, and our guest tonight is going to discuss that as a prelude to even more interesting things that happened in other parts of the world later in that same epoch. So without further ado, let me get to our guest, who is Dr. Richard Spence, who is a professor of history at the University of Idaho. His special interests include Russian, military, espionage, and occult history, and the history of anti-Semitism. One of his most popular courses deals with the role of conspiracies and secret societies in history. Oh, this could be good. His major published works include Boris Savennikov, Renegade on the Left, Eastern European Monograph / Columbia University Press, in 1991, And you can read all the rest of it on our guest page on The Other Side of Midnight, because I don't want to spend much more time doing intros. I'd like to actually talk to Dr. Spence. Good evening, and welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Good evening, Richard.
I wanted to begin with the Utah mystery, because it so connects to so many other programs that we've done over the last several months on this show. And as I said, it connects to an ongoing project that we are supporting, which has to do with an actual technology which has been developed by British engineers, has been verified by Chinese scientists and engineers, has been in the progress of being verified by an offshoot of the NASA's Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston called the NASA Eagle Works, and has now been definitely replicated to a degree where there's little doubt that there's something very mysterious going on. Namely, if you dump microwaves into this particular device, it produces thrust in a unidirectional fashion, and it doesn't require the ejection, like in a normal rocket, of fuel or the burning of fuel and oxygen or anything else, which means if you put it into space, even if it only has the thrust of a few ounces, ultimately you could go anywhere you want if you just are patient. So with that, why don't we open with your remarkable investigation and a paper which we actually published at the top of your webpage tonight at The Other Side of Midnight. It's link number 2, called Lights in the Sky, the Utah Airship Mystery. And quite frankly, as you describe this, there are going to be some people who are going to recognize an eerie parallel to a very famous television show, which in fact is coming back to network television in the next few months. So, by the way, do I call you Richard or Dr. Spence or hey you?
Why don't you call me Rick?
Okay, Rick.
Okay.
So why don't you launch us into the Utah airship mystery?
Well, I guess I'll start out by saying how I came across it. And it's one of those things that, you know, I could say if I was walking down the street, I just ran across it that way. I didn't find it in the street. I found it looking for something else. It's just sort of sheer serendipity in terms of research, and it happens that way. You know, one of the things that I do and that historians do, and just spend a lot of time, sometimes people would argue way too much time, going through musty archives, looking through page after page of material, looking for maybe that one page that will have something important on it. Hopefully some sort of smoking gun and whatever topic you're on. Well, I didn't start out to look for anything about lights in the sky over 1917 Utah. What I was doing is I was looking in online searchable old FBI records. In fact, before the FBI was the FBI, it was just the BI, the Bureau of Investigation. And back in this period, in the First World War, it's also a much smaller organization than it was later on. So, nevertheless, it had agents around the country, and it had a resident agent in Salt Lake City, which is sort of the center of this story, a fellow with the interesting name of Leon Bone. Leon Redbone, Leon Bone. And he was the BI agent who was stationed there. Well, I was actually searching for air...
Hello? Oh, we seem to be having a problem with Dr. Spence. I'll tell you what. Let's go to a break, and we'll solve this, and we shall be right back. Let me see. I have to connect some switches here. It always happens when we're into the most interesting story. So, hello, Dr. Spence, are you there?
Hello, I'm here.
Hello? Oh, okay. You are back.
Hello?
Okay.
I have been here.
Go ahead.
Okay.
You kind of disappeared for a moment.
Well, I think I was saying that I came across all of this quite by accident. I was looking for something else. I was searching the records for the term airship because I was looking for another occurrence of an airship somewhere else that had nothing to do with this. And I came across a file that's merely titled Various. And in fact, if you go looking through these old records, you'll find lots of the files that are just called various, which means it's not actually telling you who it's about or what it's about. But I figured that the word airship shows up in here somewhere, and I begin reading it, and this whole file that runs to over 300 pages is about, first of all, reports of lights in the sky, of strange, what they would then call aeroplanes or aircraft that seem to appear in different parts of the state, around Salt Lake City, in southern areas of the state, often in very remote rural areas, far away from any kind of town, or certainly any kind of airfield. And keep in mind, this is 1917, so airfields are rather few and far between, and aircraft.
Yes. I have a feeling it's going to be one of those nights tonight. Dr. Spence, can you hear me? Dr. Spence? I'll tell you what, let's go to a break and let's try to reestablish the connection because this is not going to work. So we're talking with Dr. Richard Spence. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and you are on the other side of midnight. We shall return. And we are back. Dr. Spence, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, Rick, this is really weird. This has only happened like one other time, and it's always when we have a most interesting story. One kind of wonders. I mean, if you're into secret societies and conspiracies, one might almost think that someone had you in a crosshairs.
Never really know, but, they've never invited me to join, I'll say that.
Me neither. Okay, so we were talking about you investigating the early years of the FBI in online files. Was this when Hoover was the first director? This is very strange. I'll tell you what, let's go to... I'm going to try to call you on your phone. If you can hear me, we'll go to another break, and I'm going to try to connect with your phone. Which means I will need your phone number popping up in the screen in front of me so that I can put it into the little gadget. And so let's go to a break, and then we'll come back with you on the phone and see if it works better that way. And we are back, this time for real. Dr. Spence, okay. Are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Oh, good old Ma Bell. When all in doubt fails, go back to Ma Bell.
There we go.
Okay.
All right, so let's see. Where was I? I was looking through very early World War I era Bureau of Investigation files, which are conveniently online and searchable. And I was looking for something else entirely from what I found. I was looking for the term airship. What this led me to was a file that was called Various, and it basically laid out a story that I'd certainly never heard of, and, as you said, had some kind of familiar ring to it along. So... what we had were reports that were coming in over several months in the early part of 1917 around Salt Lake City of people in various parts of the state, again, often in remote areas far from towns or airfields, who saw lights in the sky at night. Things, sometimes they would hear them, in other cases it said it would make no noise, but usually there were these aircraft, which, remember, aren't common anywhere in 1917, certainly in the American West, flying around shining bright lights, and people would sometimes describe them as signaling to each other. Well, these reports made their way back to the federal offices in Salt Lake City, and they came to the attention of the local BI agent, a fellow by the name of Leon Bone. And Bone was kind of intrigued by these stories. Initially, he just ignored them, as you figure he would. People obviously are either hallucinating or they're making up the stories. But as the number increased, he became more curious, and then one day, he saw an article in a local newspaper. And in this article, it recorded a local man, a story from a guy by the name of John Van Valkenburg, who in fact was a resident of Salt Lake City, who claimed that he and another small group of men had invented a new type of aircraft, and it used a fantastic propulsion device, and this was going to revolutionize everything. And remember, World War I is going on in the background. And another key element here is that the U.S. has just entered the war. So this is really within U.S. entered the war in April 1917, and this is now around July and August, so it's very soon after. So there's this whole sort of rush of war enthusiasm, and also there's a huge spy mania which is going on.
This is after the Lusitania.
Oh, yes, this is after the Lusitania. So one of the things that Bone, as a federal law enforcement agency and or agent, and others in Salt Lake City were doing was, of course, on the outlook for the Kaiser's agents. Now, it might seem unlikely that the Kaiser would have agents in Salt Lake City, but they didn't think it was. So there's a very heightened sense of German spies that could be anywhere. So one of the ideas that someone thinks is that, well, you know, if there's these weird planes flying around at night, it must be the Kaiser. There must somehow be Germans behind it.
Hmm.
So this is what first leads. You have to keep in mind the sort of spy mania which is going on that makes him decide against what seemed to be his better judgment that maybe I should look into it. And then he sees this newspaper article in which here are these local guys who claim to have some sort of wonderful invention and actually say that the lights that people have been seeing are their craft. So he makes contact with Van Valkenburg and his small group of essentially what are followers in some way, or associates, and they spin this wonderful tale to him. And they tell Bone that, well, what we actually have is that we have this propulsion device, which is about the size of a human fist, and in some way uses rotating discs to create propulsion, which allows us to get inside these crafts that we build, and we can just go up into the atmosphere to 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 feet in a matter of seconds.
Good grief.
And he claims that he is able to fly from Salt Lake City to San Francisco in about 45 minutes. They claim that they fly as far north as the North Pole and beyond that. You know, particularly for 1917, pretty fantastic story. Now, the other thing in this is that where did Van Valkenburg, you know, he, by the way, by trade, is a tile setter. He's a mason.
A real mason.
A real mason. Okay. He's also the member of a Masonic lodge, too, I might add. He's that kind of mason. But he is a mason, a tile setter. And just about everyone else connected with this either tends to be involved in masonry, you know, masonry work, or they're involved in mining. Again, this is Salt Lake City, so maybe that's not too unusual, but you don't find farmers or bakers or doctors or lawyers. They're all men who've generally worked outdoors. Some of them have a certain degree of mechanical skill, but none of them are inventors or engineers in that respect. They don't seem to have any kind of technical background. Well, what they revealed to Bone is that where they got this wonderful technology from was from this being that they call the Adept. And the Adept apparently lives in some sort of, well, for today they don't use the term orbiting, but I guess we would. He lives in some sort of craft which hovers about 40, 50,000 feet above the Earth, and they can go back and forth between that abode. And in some way he has given them, he's picked them out as his chosen people in order to give them this technology. So Bone...
And this is all in the FBI files.
Yeah, this is all comes up because all these guys are subsequently interrogated.
So they actually bring them in and put the lights on them and sit around with cigarettes and grill them.
Bone doesn't do it because Bone becomes, to one degree or another, a believer in what they're doing.
Hmm.
Now, later he'll try to explain...
Rick, you know what this is sounding like, right? did Chris Carter kind of look over your shoulder?
No, but I kept thinking. I used to be an old fan of the X-Files, and I thought, well, okay. Here, this begins to sound kind of familiar. The rotating disc thing sounds familiar.
Oh, my God.
The sort of religious... I mean, eventually what Van Valkenburg is running is this kind of quasi-religious cult, which centers around this miraculous airship and its even more miraculous technology and the even more miraculous and unseen adept which seems to be guiding everything.
Hmm.
Which eventually turns out to be a guy named Nils Olsen.
A Swede?
Which seems to be a local person. That's essentially the name that they use for him, that Nels. is who the old man, the other term they use for them. But Bone becomes drawn into this. His later explanation to his superiors in Washington is, he goes, look, I didn't quite believe these guys, but on the other hand, they were so convincing that I had to believe they were onto something. And so I joined their group, and I let them sort of initiate me into it so I could figure out what they were doing.
The first Fox Mulder.
Okay, but this created... and he, by the way, he is in communication. He writes all of this to a guy named A. Bruce Belasti.
Back in Washington.
Back in Washington. Because this, that, and A. Bruce Belasti is the chief of the Bureau of Investigation.
Oh, good grief.
This is pre-Hoover.
This is pre-Hoover, so this, yeah, okay.
This goes up to the top. Belasti says, well, see what they've got, see what they can find. And, of course, if they have any kind of detention, well, the government wants it.
Okay, let me stop you there, because this investigation is all going on against the backdrop of newspaper reports and ordinary citizens and lots of people all over Utah seeing something in the night sky doing weird stuff.
Yeah. So keep in mind, whatever it is that Valkenburg and his buddies may or may not be making up, people are really reporting the lights. So what it is that Van Valkenburg and his friends are claiming to be those lights and talking about this invention. Now, keep in mind, no one, including Bone, ever sees the airship.
Ever.
Ever.
Wow.
He never sets eyes on it. And it turns out that Van Valkenburg is the only person who's ever actually flown in it. But the other people, and there are eight or nine other men around him, all seem to completely believe that this exists and that the adept exists. So Bone becomes drawn far enough into this that other people, other federal officers, including U.S. Attorney General or acting Deputy Attorney General in Salt Lake City, think that Bone has kind of gone over the edge. They think that he's lost objectivity and he's been completely taken in by people who are either con men or spies.
Gosh, I wonder why.
So they call in another agent, a guy named Robert Whitson, who's pulled in from Los Angeles. And he's brought in to take over. He's not actually brought in to take over Bone's investigation. They let Bone continue. He's to carry out a parallel investigation, essentially spying on Bone and the rest of them.
This is X-Files.
This is X-Files. So Whitson is an absolute firm believer that this has to be the work of German spies.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the assumption he goes on. So he brings in men who begin tailing and following Van Valkenburg and Bone, and they trace them to various meetings, and they realize that, well, there are nine men involved in this, and then eventually they figure out that, no, there's a larger group of around 22. And again, most of them are residents in and around Salt Lake City, more or less respectable men. They find out some interesting stuff. They found out that Van Valkenburg, for instance, is having an affair, and he's married.
Mm-hmm.
So they catch him in an extramarital affair, which becomes a tad embarrassing.
Which in those days was a big deal.
With a, certainly a much bigger deal than it is now. And eventually it's one of those things that, since they can't pin anything else, they actually consider arresting him or getting him arrested on those charges. Because Whitson is again, convinced these people are pernicious spies, but he can't really prove, first of all, you can't find the airship they're talking about. So if they're actually flying this thing and it's somehow an insidious German invention, well, they can't physically find it exists. So what it eventually comes down to is that, the other little interesting thing is that one of the things Whitson finds out is that somehow or another, it is never explained in the file, Bone and Van Valkenburg and the rest know that he's watching them.
Hmm.
So for weeks, everything that his tails are observing, and they're making these daily reports where these guys go. I mean, the most mundane thing, they go down to the store, they get their shoes shined, they go to the bar, but they're keeping track of them day and night. And The interesting thing later is that Van Valkenburg and the rest are aware they're being watched, but they don't seem to change their behavior. They carry out the same meetings they had before.
Mm-hmm.
Whitson eventually becomes so frustrated with this and pressed to come up with something that he decides, well, he's going to haul them in and he's going to question them. So he pulls them in and he grills Van Valkenburg and he grills the others and he asks them about all of the details of these stories.
Okay, hold it right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. Things seem to be technically working pretty well.
Great.
My guest this morning is Dr. Richard Spence. We're discussing the Great Utah Airship Mystery, 1917-1918. My name's Richard C. Hoagland. You're on the other side of midnight. And we'll be right back. And we're back on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Dr. Richard Spence, and we're discussing the Great Utah Airship Mystery, and the precursor to the FBI, the BI, has just hauled in a bunch of potential suspects in Salt Lake City in to grill them on the airship mystery and their participation. Rick, continue.
Well, Whitson gets these guys in the chair and starts questioning them and assumes that they're going to confess their guilt and conspire with the Kaiser or whatever else is going on. And one of the things he confronts them with, especially Van Valkenburg, remember, who is the key figure in this, he's the center that all the rest of them revolve around. The only guy who actually claims to have met the adept, the only one who actually turns out says that I really flew in the plane, or craft, as they refer to it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that Whitson points out is that, well, you know, what you're describing here is absurd. You're describing something that defies all the laws of known physics. You know, you claim that it runs in an engine that consumes no fuel, no electricity, other than these rotating discs, has no moving parts. You can fly at what then sounded like fantastic speeds. And also, you claim that you flew for 30,000 miles, I think it was. You started out here, and you flew straight north, and that you ended up, get this, ended up in a land in which was a different race of people lived who had fantastic inventions of their own.
God.
So it's almost as if he's describing another planet, but it's not. He claims that it's still somehow on Earth.
Well, shades of the stories around Admiral Byrd.
Or Admiral Byrd. You know, the thing is that, you know, he puts it and says, you know, you can't fly 30,000 miles north. The North Pole isn't that far away. The Earth isn't that big. So clearly, you guys are just making this up, or you're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And Van Valkenburg sticks to his guns. He goes, look, I can't, you know, I admit I can't prove any of this, but it's true. I know what it was that I saw. I knew who I spoke to. And the other men who have been associating with him also are unshakable in their belief of what he said. And this is where Whitson begins, I think, to get the idea, of the sort of whiff that what I'm dealing with here isn't a bunch of spies. What I'm dealing with are some sort of strange breed of religious fanatics.
Hmm.
And there are kind of odd religious overtones in this.
Well, this is Mormon country, so he would, I guess, kind of leap to that conclusion, right?
And indeed, and Van Valkenburg, and he certainly, and at least a couple of others, are members of the LDS Church.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that Van Valkenburg claims is that the Mormon Church itself was in some way interested in this invention and wanted to gain control of it. He also claimed to be working for the Mormon Church's Secret Service, and no one knew that they had one. What actually Whitson got him on, the one thing that he could halt, the one charge he could get them, was impersonating a federal agent.
Hmm.
And the claim that Van Valkenburg had gone around, and he basically told people, look, I'm working for the government, and he had a letter which said that this man is essentially working for the government and that local law enforcement should assist him and not bother him.
And who was the letter from?
The letter was given to him by Leon Bone. Remember? The agent
the
who
agent.
First began investigating it. And so, in a sense, Van Valkenburg wasn't impersonating a federal agent. He actually had a letter that sort of deputized him.
Right.
So his argument was that, look, I have a letter that says, you know, from your agent, and you never removed bone from the case, so I'm not sure what it is that I've done wrong. And you may think that I'm crazy, but I know what I saw, and I'm sticking to it. So eventually Whitson puts him and one of his other associates, on a man named Althoff, on trial. But a third, a fellow by the name of Charles Henderson, who also won't budge in his testimony, he essentially has judged insane and put into the state mental institution.
But back up. You know, he's actually taken to a court?
Yeah, he has. Van Valkenburg and Althoff end up in court on trial for impersonating federal agents.
Even though there's a letter from Bone?
Even though there's a letter saying that, you know, probably, from some of the descriptions, Van Valkenburg sounds like he made maybe more out of that letter than it was.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, you know, if I would think that with a good lawyer, he could obscure that fairly well.
And as
Bone, the initial agent, noted, they really had no case. There was no way that they were going to be able to get a case. They couldn't convict him of being a spy. They couldn't really convict him of impersonating a federal agent. And in some way, this trial was just a way to, you know, to try to justify the time and effort that had been spent investigating it.
It was basically a witch hunt.
Well, apparently a huge waste of time and money. But nevertheless, what happened in the midst of this trial is that Whitson gets the prosecutor to call it off and gets a summary judgment that Van Valkenburg and Althoff will also be committed against their will to the state mental institution in Provo.
The Soviet Union used to do this.
If you say the wrong thing, you're crazy. So this was it. The idea was that, look, we're not going to try to actually prosecute them for any crime. We're just going to say that these men are obviously insane by the things that they're claiming, and therefore they should be institutionalized.
And you get a judge to rubber stamp it.
And they got a judge to rubber stamp it. But the strange thing is that they only spend a few weeks. But the trial is basically in April and May, and then by June...
Of what, 1918?
1918. So, apparently, they were cured very quickly. So, I mean, this is one of those things, again, that you know, apparently they're too crazy to actually stand trial. But then, after a month or so in the loony bin, they're okay to let loose.
Now, you looked for all, and you found all this in the FBI files that are online. Did you do any cross-checking with the local paper, like the paper in Salt Lake City, the Desert, I forget what the name is, or any
Deseret
other
Desert News, yeah. Found some other articles about the trial. There are articles about the trial. There are articles about the lights. Some of those articles are actually newspaper clippings are reproduced in the BI file.
Oh.
They would clip some of those. The other thing I did was really to try to do some background, use census records, in particular the census, to figure out who these people were, what their... I mean, this is how I found out what Van Valkenburg did for a living. Because it would list... You can find him listed in the census. You can find that he's a longtime resident. You can find that the other man, Althoff, was a mining engineer and you know, later dies in El Dorado, California. A faithful member of the local lodge until his dying day.
Hmm.
And once this is over, I mean, once they are, you know, sent off to the bin and then released, you never hear anything more about this. The file just ends.
Oh. Like it was a buyout to make everything just go away.
Everything went away. No one touches them. Leon Bone stays in the BI. He ends up, he goes to Los Angeles, where he is a federal investigator there, at least until the 1930s. So his career continues. Whitson's career continues somewhere else. Van Valkenburg and Althoff and the others just go back to what they were doing before. And there's nothing that really, they just don't show up
this
thereafter.
Is,
they live for years after that, but no one mentions this again. Now, the other interesting thing is that while the trial was going on and after the trial continued, people were still seeing lights apparently they seem to go away after a while. But this was something that Bone pointed out. He goes, look, I'm still getting these reports of people saying that they're seeing these mystery lights at night, and if these are the guys who you actually think were creating them, well, you have them in jail, so they can't be doing it. So it's one of those things that leaves a more questions unanswered. I mean, it doesn't really answer anything. It doesn't answer whether or not there ever was any kind of craft to begin with, whether this, you know. The simple explanation would be that Van Valkenburgh was a very convincing con man, and that in some way all of this was designed to attract attention and to gather people around him and to seem important, and so he invented this kind of fantastic story.
How does that describe and explain the lights?
It doesn't. Doesn't explain the lights.
So it's not an explanation.
One idea is that he may have never had anything to do with him, or he, you know, what connection his claims had. But as Bone pointed out, he goes, look, if he wanted to make up a story, then he would have made up a better story. I mean, he acknowledged that his claims about how far they would fly seemed to be fantastic and unexplainable. He knew how big the Earth actually was. So why was he seemingly including these elements that made it seem as if he was... I mean, if he was going to come up with a story, wouldn't he have come up with one that would hold a little more water?
Mm-hmm.
And nor could Bone explain why other people believed in him so implicitly, why they were so fervent in their belief, and to what degree this had to do with some sort of religious aspect of it that he wasn't sure might be going. There was also some initiation they went through. It's not clear that Bone went through this himself, but the others did, you know, physical and sort of, you know, because they had been selected by the adept to be the first. There was also like a chain letter, a chain cult in this, if you want to. There would be the first nine that would be accepted, and then they would find nine more and so on and so on and so on. And then you're going to get to whole...
magic numbers.
A large magic number. I think eventually there are going to be 144,000 of them, and then something, you know, miraculous will happen. So this thing is operating at different levels, sort of elements of religious faith, but then there is this element of... And where did he come up with this description of counter-rotating discs?
Yes, that's intriguing.
That's one of the things that struck me, because I knew I'd heard references to things like that before. And again, where would he come up with this, a man who was essentially a stone worker, a tiler by trade, come up with that in 1917? It's also fairly clear he's, again, talking about something in a synchronous orbit, and yet that term didn't exist at the time either. So it remains... It's one of these things that sort of appears, and then it disappears, and something that sort of struck me about it is that early on, I think I mentioned, when Leon Bone had first discovered this group and then was reporting their claims to his boss in Washington, his boss, Bilesky, had said that, well, you know, if there's anything to this, if they really have this type of thing, the government would definitely want it. And at one point, Bilesky talked about sending out a couple of people to Utah. You know, once these guys are going to show it to you, then we're going to send out our experts to inspect it. And Van Valkenburgh agreed that once the device was perfected, which apparently it wasn't, they would turn over the whole thing to the government. But of course, nobody ever saw the device. Bone never saw it. It was never perfected. A demonstration was never given. And this is where the doubts then began to increase.
See,
Rick, the
thing in my mind is you've got an experienced FBI, BI investigator, Bone, who latches onto this, and he doesn't seem to follow investigative procedure, which is show me the evidence. He seems to get co-opted almost mentally or psychically or something into a cult.
My impression of it, and this is just from reading his report, I mean, again, his explanation was that, look, I wanted to find out what these guys were up to, and the only way I could find out was to sort of win their confidence. So that was his argument to his superiors. I was, you know, I didn't totally believe them, and I didn't totally disbelieve them, but I thought that I would get more out of them if I appeared to be sympathetic and interested than if I come on like gangbusters, as Whitson did. So remember, Whitson arrests them, interrogates them, and tries them, and he never gets anything out of them.
Do you think there was a good cop, bad cop between Whitson and Bone?
Well, if there is, it's pretty well hidden in the file. Whitson seemed to express nothing but sort of contempt for Bone. In his, you know, his idea was that Bone was, you know, had simply, you know, as you say, violated procedure, that he had not reported everything that he knew, that he was too credulous, he was too close to these people, and therefore he was no longer objective, that he had lost sight of what it was that he was supposed to do.
Hmm.
I think, sort of reading between the lines a bit, that Bone was probably more intrigued and taken in than he later admitted.
Well, the fact that he maintained a career in the Bureau of Investigation until he retired shows that somebody must have believed that he was kind of playing undercover and that he wasn't really part of something weirder.
Well, I think that they couldn't find out that he'd really done any... No, he might have taken the investigation differently, but his argument was that he was trying to get the truth out of these guys, that there was any truth, but he was going about it in a different way. He was going about it by appearing to be their friend and taking an interest in what they were doing, as opposed to accusing them of being spies and threatening them. Whitson essentially threatens them.
As an historian, are you struck by the fact that this is the first time this story has ever come to light?
Well, you know, I expected the only thing that I found, I mean, maybe something else has emerged at the time, but when I was doing the research, and that was only about a year or so ago, that I found that someone had found some of the newspaper articles about the case, especially about the trial, and that those were online, but they had knew nothing about the actual investigative file. And, you know, I would never have found that file unless I knew the names of people who were involved, because remember, the file is just marked various. It's not marked Van Valkenburg, it's not marked Airship. And I was just searching for where the term Airship came up, and I found this whole thing. It just kind of fell into my lap. And I thought, well, you know, this isn't something I'd normally write an article about, but this is kind of too good to pass up. And I was really just sort of interested to see how it was going to turn up. I have to admit, I have this, you know, if I wanted to think more sneakily about the thing, is there something going on in the background that the file doesn't reveal? And there, you know, one could argue, I'm not sure how firmly, but one could argue is that, well, what you've got here is that this whole case comes up and there's claims of this invention, and you've got two different agents looking at it, and eventually these guys get pulled into court, sent to an insane asylum, let go. Was that to shut them up? Was that the whole purpose of putting them in the mental hospital? To essentially shut them, to say that if you keep telling these stories, if you keep talking about what you're talking about, we can put you in here and never let you out.
So you're proposing there maybe was the first UFO cover-up, government cover-up of a UFO phenomenon.
I'm mildly suspicious that there's a cover-up of something.
Well, the fact that nobody talked afterwards and Bone didn't write a book.
Yeah. No, Bone didn't write about it, never seems to have mentioned it. Everybody just seems to have gone back to their ordinary lives.
That's so bizarre.
This never happened.
That is so absolutely bizarre. Now, I mean, give us a sense of history at that time. You know, I mean, aircraft were still amazing at that time, ordinary propeller-driven aircraft. This is so many light years beyond that, you'd think that somebody would have tried to tell a story outside of this limited group, because all the people that were seeing these things, didn't the newspaper want to follow up on what people were seeing and reporting?
Well, the newspapers liked the story, but, you know, people, the stories were the same, that, you know, there were these strange lights at night, and sometimes there's one, or sometimes there's two or three, and, you know, they're one of the places they would appear, there were reports coming in were around Moab. I don't know how many people know Utah, but Moab's sort of down in the southern part of the state. you know, quite a ways away from Salt Lake City and quite a ways away from anything else. But I think there was some report of four of these lights flying around, you know, things that sound suspiciously what, like, people later describe as UFOs flying in formation. I'm not sure that's exactly, I mean, the question is, how would someone in 1917 describe that? Because the only way that they could describe it is under the terms and references that they had at the time. So remember, things like unidentified flying, no one uses that. They're just mysterious airships who are, you know, which, and lights, very powerful lights. Of course, one of the other things von Valkenburg claimed is that, you'll love this, that they had a death ray as well. Something else the Adept had given them is a death ray that could melt entire battleships and armies. And again, keep in mind, the war is going on in the background. The U.S. has just entered it. So were there people, you know, someone off in Washington who hears that there's some guys in Utah have this fantastic invention that will allow them to fly hundreds of miles an hour in any direction indefinitely in any kind of weather, and oh yes, they have a death ray. Well, I mean, no matter how loony that might sound, there's always that question, what if they do have a death ray? You should, you know, do you not want to check that out? So it's just one of those things that's, in many ways, this sort of puzzling case in which you're left, you know, and I'll frankly say, you know, in many ways, von Valkenburg's story, in terms of the seemingly the sort of sheer irrational aspects of it, sounds crazy.
Sounds so crazy that it might actually have something going for it.
Or it may. And the so-called alienist, you know, the psychiatrist that examined him, said that, well, you know, this guy is sane in every way except the story he's telling. He's kind of selectively nuts. See, otherwise, we can't, and I know that's not to say you can't be selectively nuts, but I think it was Churchill that said, we're all sort of insane about something. But you know, here they are. You know, we can't really find anything wrong with him, except he doggedly insists that this ludicrously impossible story he's telling is true.
But see,
he never recants it.
For someone with that kind of background, a kind of a normal laborer background, you know, he was a mason, a real mason, right?
Yeah.
The imagination required to put all this together and then connect it to a separate phenomenon going on at the same time, it just doesn't ring to me like the creativity would have been there. Where did the creativity come from?
There was one thing that Whitson latched onto, which is that he thought that von Valkenburg had gotten part of the story from a book that had recently been published. And actually, it was a book that was published around 1915 called The Moon Maker. And then I think The Man That Shook the World. And it's one of these things, I discuss it in the article, and it was fairly popular, and it was kind of, I don't know how many of your listeners may know the Jules Verne story, Master of the World. You know, this is a kind of super scientist who's decided that humanity needs correcting, and he has these fantastic inventions that will allow him to, you know, demonstrate his power.
Well, during this time period, there were a lot of stories like that. There was the Tom Swift and his electric whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was Verne, of course. There was H.G. Wells, all right, which was just a few years before, just in the other side of the century. When did the Shaver mysteries come out under, what's his name, the editor?
Richard Shaver?
Mm-hmm.
I think those are in the 40s.
Okay.
Those are later. But there's a certain similarity to, you know, of coming up with stories that appear to be just completely irrational, and yet you find people who will believe in them very firmly.
All right.
So
Go ahead.
Well, Whitson, the best he could come up with, and he never made any clear case for it, because he could never, as far as I could tell, actually show that von Valkenburg had read these books. But he goes, look, there are stories that are sort of similar to this, and that one of the things that this this super scientist used in these books was a thing called the Flying Ring.
Mm-hmm.
This was this kind of aircraft called the Flying Ring. And he thought that Van Valkenburg had read that and cobbled it together with various elements of some sort of, you know, whatever occult group he was connected to, and he would come up with a story.
Hmm.
But he still couldn't really explain why Van Valkenburg would include these other elements in the story, you know, the speed and the great distances and apparently going to some sort of, you know, miraculous land, which, I mean, if you want to play around with this, it's even got sort of little vague intimations of alien abduction in it, doesn't it?
A bit. See, my two questions. Do you think you have plumbed the depths of the story, is there more out there that someone who kind of was a writer working on this full time could find more records, more stories, more first eyewitness accounts? For instance, in the 1890s, when the great airship mysteries across the entire country were occurring, there were reports of landings of people, farmers, seeing guys fixing these craft and giving them water and getting, you know, messages from them and all that. Were there any personal accounts from people seeing the lights?
There's a press article which doesn't connect to the lights directly, but again, Whitson thought it had a bearing on it. And this actually wasn't in the Utah. This was in the California desert. It was in the Mojave Desert. And some men apparently had, you know, driven their car out into the desert. See if this sounds familiar. And it had broken down, or they'd gotten lost, and, you know, they were about to die of thirst. And this airship appears, which apparently sounded very much like an airplane of some kind. It sort of comes down and gives them fuel and water and helps them get back to civilization, and then just disappears.
Hmm.
It never tells them where they came from.
And Whitson connects this to the Utah mystery?
Well, his idea again was that Van Valkenburg had read that story, and that in some way that gets it. His concept was that Van Valkenburg was sort of building his tale out of bits and pieces of things that he'd gotten from either press reports like that, and that seemed to connect that Van Valkenburg would later claim that he was first approached by the adept. He had a kind of spiritual experience in the desert. He was out in the desert, and this is where the adept appeared to him, and this is where the whole thing first began. And he thought, well, maybe he in some way borrowed that from these guys who got lost in the desert, and some guys show up in an airship or an airplane and assist them.
Okay, when we come back, I'll ask my other question. My guest this morning is Dr. Richard Spence. We've been discussing the great Utah airship mystery. And this is Amanda B., Amanda Best. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return.
Can't turn it around some days. Some days, I'm never right in every red light. Can't find the bright side some days. Some days, I try to explain to those I haven't chased away, but no one seems to understand. Some days.
And we are back. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we are talking this morning with Dr. Richard Spence. Rick to his friends, and I guess we're his friends because that's what we're calling him this morning. All right, my other question. Did you ever find any real German connection between the mystery in Utah and where we're going to be going next?
I mean, were there any German spies in Utah?
Mm-hmm.
Not that they ever caught, no. There was this. Okay. I mean, there were one of the things that was in the vicinity of Salt Lake City at the time. It was Fort Douglas. I think Fort Douglas is still there. But in 1917, Fort Douglas was an internment camp for German aliens, which means that German aliens who were judged to be a threat to national security were rounded up, and they were sent to Fort Douglas. Others were sent to Fort Oglethorpe in Georgia, which, in case anybody wonders whether there were enemy alien internment camps in World War I, U.S., there were, and one of them was right there. And that was one of the things that seemed to concern them, that because Germans, some of whom, you know, most of these, I assume, there probably were some actual spies who ended up in Fort Douglas, but not many. A lot of them were just unfortunate people who had been denounced and were then interned. But the idea was that because all of these Germans were being gathered and sort of put next to this, this might then give Berlin reason to take an interest in what was going on. But that's about the only connection. A couple of the people who were involved in Van Valkenburg's group, he, by the way, is of Dutch extraction from New York. But there were a couple of them, a guy named John Gies and another fellow by the name of Valtink. They both were either German immigrants or of German background. But no, there wasn't the slightest thing to tie any of these people to a German spy ring or to the Kaiser. Other than the fact that some of their names were either German or sounded vaguely German in that regard. I came across, by the way, I was mentioning before the last break, the books that Agent Whitson thought that Van Valkenburg might have gotten some of his ideas from, and your listeners might find those interesting. The two books, the writer is a fellow by the name of Arthur Train. Actually, there are two authors, Arthur Train and Robert Wood. And those books are The Man Who Rocked the Earth, which was published in 1915, and The Moonmaker, which was a sequel, which came out in 1916. And that features the idea of a mysterious scientific genius named Pax and his flying ring aircraft. And those are... It's also, I think, one of the things I note in the in my article is that it's also not too long before, it's in 1914, that Edgar Rice Burroughs published At the Earth's Core, which, you know, was his version of the Hollow Earth. So there is the possibility that John Van Valkenburg could have read all of these things and cobbled together and used bits and pieces of them for his story, but again, there's no real evidence that he ever saw any of them. I mean, and, they were around, and he might have seen them, but can't make a direct connection between them.
Well,
go ahead.
No,
you were asking about how what research might carry this on. One of the things, and if I was going to look into this further, or if anybody else wanted to look into it further,
it begs to be looked at further. Wouldn't you agree?
I would hope there would be some more resolution to it.
Where did this Van Valkenburg get the idea that counter-rotating discs give you anti-gravity?
I have no idea.
Because there's some real physics that says that might actually work.
Yeah, I know there have been experiments with that that have tried to show reductions in weight or in gravitation.
Yes, and there's also crop circles in England showing counter-rotating thingies that are trying to tell somebody something. From somewhere. From someone.
That's one of the little mysteries about this case, or not so little mysteries about it, is where Van Valkenburg would even conceive. And where in 1917 would someone conceive of that?
See, when I heard this story from my producer, I thought, oh my God, we've got to put this on the air. Because to me, when you connect the fact that they were all part of a Masonic lodge, and they're talking about, you know, higher beings, adepts, supreme, whatever, this kind of echoes of the kind of mystery school passing on of secret information, which, if you trace it back far enough, may actually come from an era where, you know, previous human civilizations actually could do some of this stuff if you, you know, think that any ideas of previous high-tech civilizations on Earth are at all credible.
Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of threads that seem to connect this case in different directions. And the idea of, you know, whether it's some kind of past super technology or whether it's something that aliens, you know, whether this adept is some sort of, you know, disguised alien, or then just goes back to it's just a very, you know, weird story that this one guy has made up and that he's able to somehow convince other people of the credibility of without showing them a shred of actual evidence.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that astounding?
Wait.
There was a shred, and that was all the reports, public reports, newspaper reports, of weird things going on in the sky. Now, that wasn't nationwide. You weren't hearing reports from New York and Poughkeepsie and Albuquerque and St. Louis and whatever. It was this little place around southern Utah, right?
Well, it's a various place. There are things around Logan and the outskirts of Salt Lake City and down in Moab. One of the things that Bone noticed is that a lot of the reports seem to come from remote areas in the southern part of the state. And I don't know how many of your listeners have even today gone around southern Utah, but there are some really remote areas.
Have you ever looked at some of the ancient Aboriginal, they're not cave paintings, they're like huge depictions of strange beings on the walls in red ochre, and they've been dubbed the aliens, and they're right there in southern Utah.
In the Canyonlands.
Is
there a connection between that in this case? Like everything else here, I mean, who knows what's going on?
This sounds like somebody's got to really dig into this, because there could be some really interesting gems if you dig deeper.
It's even the other possibility that was some considered, first of all, is that, he's a con man, and what he's trying to do is he's trying to use this as a way to get money. And there actually was at least one case where he and a couple of his partners went to the mayor of Salt Lake City and actually said, we'd like to know if we could borrow some money. It wasn't that much. It was like $5,000, $8,000. And they were rather politely told
But wait. In today's dollars, how much is that?
Well, multiply that by 20.
So that's almost 200 grand.
Yeah.
That's not a trivial amount of money.
Not a trivial, but it was, if you were going to go for, if the scam was to get money, they didn't try very hard.
Mm-hmm.
They make this one sort of, they go, this is about how much money. The argument was, we need about this amount of money to complete the work. Okay, we can't show you this device. The adept won't let us show it to you until it's complete. And then there was also this thing that Van Valkenburg, I think, mentions that, the other reason we didn't show it to you is that the adept doesn't want this to be used for war.
Mm.
He doesn't want it to be used as a weapon. I don't know why he gave him a death ray if he didn't want to use it.
Exactly.
But at any rate, he doesn't want to be used as a weapon, and his feeling is that, if we turn this over to the government, that's what you guys will do with it, which, of course, they would.
But didn't Van Valkenburg and the group also say, if this is perfected, it's basically free energy, perpetual energy, energy from someplace? You don't need coal, you don't need oil, you don't need gas.
It draws its energy out of the air, they would describe it.
Very Teslonian?
Doesn't use any kind of fuel. You can travel indefinitely. We don't know how fast you can go, because they never apparently tried to go more than 1,000 miles an hour, because I guess that freaked them out. He didn't. So, you can fly, and you can fly in these craft, and they're stable in any kind of weather, and nothing can harm you.
Now, right there's an interesting mystery, because the materials technology of 1917, if Van Valkenburg and his cohorts claimed they had built this device on the plans from the guy upstairs,
mm-hmm.
how would materials in 1917 have withstood 1,000-mile-an-hour velocity through the atmosphere?
That's a good question. And keep in mind, what he's describing, to the extent he describes this as all, is not in any way like an airplane. In fact, at one point he says they've built five different craft of different sizes, and one could hold several men, but the smallest one, which they call, the word's actually rendered two ways. It's either the tube or the tub. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think it's supposed to be the tube, which is like this one-man-sized thing about the size of a barrel, apparently, that you get into and you can just fly around in that.
Why am I thinking of this nursery rhyme? Rub-a-dub-dub, three men.
Three men in a tub. So, and it's, it doesn't fit the whole idea of what, you know, again, this is 1917. Aircraft were basically biplanes. There were some monoplanes, and they flew maybe between 100 and 150 miles an hour.
And they were made out of wood and paper.
And they're made out of, you know, cloth and paper and wire, and they've got an operative ceiling of maybe 20,000 feet, if that much, and only
maybe,
because there's no pressurization, which means that once you get above 12,000 feet, you are short of oxygen, so you can only stay up there for a certain amount of time. So they're talking about something which is completely beyond any concept of what an aircraft was or could do at that time.
And again, for stonemasons to have this imagination, even if they read a book, this is so much more elaboration beyond, you know, reading a story, reading a book.
Okay.
So obviously somebody out there in the audience, please take on this mystery and let's have something further down the line.
It might be possible, and this is an avenue I haven't explored, but it might be possible to find relatives of these men.
Mm-hmm.
Van Valkenburg in particular, would bet that there are some of his descendants who live there or somewhere else, and, you know, they may know something.
Wouldn't it be great if he kept a diary?
That would be fantastic, assuming this. I did try to run down his sort of right-hand man, this guy named Ed Althoff, who lived in L.A. and I think mentioned and died in Northern California.
And Althoff was the actual German, wasn't he?
Althoff was of German background, yeah. And I think, I don't know whether his father, I think he was native-born, or he may have been naturalized. But he was German of an extraction. But Althoff, I eventually came across someone who had recalled him or knew something about him living in El Dorado, California. And the only thing that they could come up with is that, well, nobody really knew much of anything about him. He was an old mining engineer, and he just seemed to be an ordinary guy, and they'd never heard him. As far as they knew, no one had ever heard anything about this story.
See, one of the eerie parallels, and that will segue into our next story, and you've got a million stories there that obviously we're going to have you back to tell more of them, is that just before World War II, actually in the transition between the wars, there was this huge European secret society, the Thule Society and all that, and one of the resonant themes from those people who ultimately wound up becoming the Nazis is that they were talking to somebody off-world and getting information and technology from a higher source.
Yeah.
What connects these two apparently disconnected episodes in history?
Well, I'd broaden it even further than that. I'd say that if you look through history, you find all sorts of people. You know, Joan of Arc. I don't know. One could argue Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Smith.
Did you hear the story about Saddam Hussein?
Teresa?
Did you ever hear the story about Saddam Hussein?
Well, which one?
Well, the back before the first war, Dan Rather, the guy that I knew and kind of worked with, had an in-person interview with Saddam Hussein. And I'm watching television. Remember, my background is television and CBS and all that, so I'm very interested in the body language because, you know, Rather wrote this book, The Camera Never Blinks. So when you see individuals on television, the body language, their view, the eye, you're looking at a lot more than what they're saying. And the thing that struck me before the war, he's got the whole world arrayed against him. This is Hussein. And he's absolutely calm. It's like he knows something that nobody else knows. So one of my friends, who's a psychologist from Cleveland, Ohio, who actually created the whole concept of PTSD, was asked by this government to go over to Iraq and wound up meeting with Hussein. Before the war. And so when he comes back, he's debriefed, and I was one of those who debriefed him. And I said, John, how did he strike you? And he said, he told me the most amazing story. He said, every night, Mohammed appears to him in his room and tells him it's all going to work. And that, to me, was the answer to why he appeared so centered and calm in the face of a planet against him. and the U.S. military, et cetera, et cetera. So that's another parallel to your idea that someone's talking to somebody who's not here, and that gives them this almost supernal confidence that you wouldn't expect from their situation?
Yeah, it can be the, I mean, did not say it is, but it certainly could be that if people believe that they have a contact with some higher being, you know, if God has spoken to them, the idea that somehow this puts you on such a completely different plane of reality that, you know, what is it, if that is real, then what else can't be real? And why wouldn't you believe what it is that this being is telling you? You know, the one thing I'd point out historically is that, you know, angels and gods show up and speak to people. And one of the things to notice, not always, is that that seldom turns out well.
Very good
point. Someone almost always gets hurt in the process.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've got to wonder what actually, you know, if there's something going on here, what's exactly the motivation? You know, I've occasionally sort of half joked is that, well, you know, if there are aliens and the rest of it, maybe their whole point is that they're just messing with us.
But what if they're not aliens, Rick?
Yes, what if they're not?
What if they're family? What if they're really, I mean, part of our work has been looking into, and, you know, me and Joseph Farrell have looked at this for a long time, which is, what if the terrestrial civilization we're familiar with is only a tiny legacy of something that used to be much vaster? And the, you know, family out there is still interested in what's going on here, and occasionally they send somebody to try to do something, and it, as you just said, it always seems to go wrong, but that doesn't mean that the motivations were not right. I mean, it's kind of like a plot out of Roddenberry where, remember that one called Patterns of Force, the Star Trek, where for the best possible reasons, the Federation representative instills a Nazi-like culture on this planet, and it goes horribly wrong, but but he does it because it's the most efficient way to go from a pre-technical to a post-space civilization?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, you're dealing with human beings here, and
maybe at many levels.
Creatures. Yeah.
So what I wanted to connect was your story about Constantinople, and if I don't get to Constantinople tonight, you will not have a host tomorrow because Ross will have killed me. My producer will have taken me out. So the connection that I see is you've got secret societies, you've got hints of Germans, you've got interesting high technology voodoo, and it all seems to now revolve around a place on the planet which is not very cooperative with current U.S. policy vis-a-vis these madmen called ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So take us back to the same time frame, but now take us back to Constantinople and set the scene for the prelude to what happened in World War II.
Well, it actually goes back a little bit before 1917. It goes back between about 1900 and 1914. That's a decade or so before the war breaks out. And during that period, Constantinople, which is today Istanbul, but I'll stick with the old name since we're talking about when that was operative, was the capital then not of Turkey as it is today, but it was the capital of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire was one of those countries that, when the war did break out, was going to be drawn into the war on the side of Germany and its allies, and as a result of that would be defeated and destroyed. So one of the interesting things to keep in mind is that the First World War and the destruction of the Ottoman Empire, its partition, is what creates the Middle East that exists today.
Hmm.
So if you go back, you will find out that Iraq, Syria, the Republic of Turkey, Jordan, Palestine, Israel, Saudi Arabia, all of those countries, if you go back and look before the war, they're not there. It's the Ottoman Empire, and they are carved out of it. Iraq, in particular, is an artificial creation.
I was just going to say, these are all kind of artificial lines on maps having nothing to do with people or tribes.
By the British and the French. Those are the ones who draw the lines on the maps. Nobody locally had anything to do with that. And they've been upset about it ever since.
You mean the locals?
The locals, yeah. Right. These were sort of countries that were created often against the will of the locals that were there. Well, in a way, this process gets underway because in the decade or so before the war breaks out, there's a revolution in the Ottoman Empire, a thing called the Young Turk Revolution. And the old sultan is essentially deposed, and a puppet sultan is put in charge, and a military junta takes over the empire. And these guys are going to have trouble of their own. I don't know. Have you heard of the Armenian massacres?
Yes. And you know where I first heard about it?
In a
Star Trek episode written by Gene Roddenberry.
The reference point for all things.
Well, not all things, but it certainly brought it into common parlance.
Yeah. But that's one of those things which I don't think is known as well as it should be.
Not at all.
One of the things that this Young Turk regime would do once they get into the war is to carry out the 20th century, arguably the 20th century's first systematic genocide. Even though the Turkish government today still denies that that an Armenian genocide happened, it did. Mm. You can read about it in the newspapers at the time. It was well covered, actually. But that is what makes Constantinople the capital of this decaying Ottoman Empire, with this nationalist revolutionary junta which is in control of it. It makes it a very interesting place. It makes it a certain center for intrigue. And what struck me is that if you look at it in these years, if you look at Constantinople just before the First World War breaks out, you find a number of sort of interesting people coming through. So, for instance, you mentioned just a little while ago the Thule Society, this mystical society that would crop up actually in the latter part of the First World War in Germany, and which then is going to have a very close link to the Nazi Party that will emerge after the war. In fact, you can say with, I think, a fair degree of accuracy that the initial Nazi Party, or what was then the German Workers' Party, is a kind of political extension or subsidiary of the Thule Society.
Hmm.
It was a kind of political party which they created. Now, the guy who is the kind of guru or the central figure in the Thule Society is a guy who goes by the name of Rudolf von Sobotendorf. That's a mouthful, but von Sobotendorf spends much of the years before the war, guess where? In Constantinople, in Turkey, and it's there that he is initiated into the mystical society, or actually societies, and he comes across the occult doctrines that he will then take back to Germany and use as part of the basis for the Thule Society.
Now, if you want to see a picture, folks, of what von Sobotendorf looks like, we have picture number 6 under Radio Pictures tonight on So if you go to Radio Pictures, look at image number 6. He doesn't look like a conspiratorial type person. He looks kind of like a dentist.
I don't know, at some point, his actual name is Rudolf Glauer.
Huh.
This is the thing that a lot of the people that I do research on almost always turn out to have been somebody else. It's not unusual to assume different identities. His claim, he was originally Rudolf Glauer, and I think at one point he was a railway employee in Germany, and then he was adopted by a German nobleman named von Sobotendorf. But maybe one of the more intriguing things, remember, von Sobotendorf, or Glauer, whichever you want to say him, in his years supposedly of studying mysticism in the Near East, in Turkey, studied for a while at the foot of a man by the name of Termudi. And Termudi was a citizen of the Ottoman Empire, but he was also a Jew.
Hmm.
And therefore, the man who would form the Thule Society, which would be influential upon the early Nazis, admitted that part of his own spiritual learning came from a Jewish mystic in the Ottoman Empire. Now, there's an interesting connection for you.
Hmm.
But at the same time that von Sobotendorf is there, there are other people running around. And one of them who's very active in that area, in fact, who was arguably born in around Constantinople and certainly raised there, is a fellow that I've been fascinated in a long time, a guy by the name of Sir Basil Zaharoff. And Zaharoff is, well, he's one of the 20th century's first billionaires or billionaires.
Yeah, we have a shot of him in picture 5 under Radio with Pictures.
Yeah, and you won't find many shots of him because one of the things that Basil Zaharoff didn't like was having his picture taken.
Oh, that's a clue.
He tended to avoid having photographs taken.
So he wanted to be the guy behind the scenes.
Well, very much so. And the way that he made his money was, well, his he was best known, if you look him up, if you look up Zaharoff, he's known as the Merchant of Death. And the reason for that is that he sold weapons. He's an arms dealer. And he principally worked for Vickers, which was a British company, but he also worked for Krupps, and he worked for Schneider Creusot, which was a French company. And he sold cannons and munitions and rifles and machine guns to anybody who would pay him. And he received a commission on that. And he also branched out into other things like oil and radio. He was an important figure in the early Marconi apparatus. But he really made his money off of dealing arms. And Zaharoff had what he called his system. And this is what made him such a good arms merchant. Is that one of the things he realized is that, okay, you've got a conflict going on here, or you've got a potential conflict. Well, you've got two people at least involved in that.
So you mean the coming World War One?
Yeah, coming World War One, or he actually in the other thing that he's busy, there's a thing called the Balkan Wars, which takes place in 1912 and 1913, just immediately preceding World War One, kind of a prequel. And this is when the little Balkan states of Bulgaria and Greece,
kind of like
Serbia,
Spain preceded World War II.
Yes, very similar in that respect. And they are being armed, and they actually wage war against the Ottoman Empire. So these wars going on, and that's one of the reasons, again, Constantinople is a good base for this stuff. Because there's lots of small nationalistic states that all have territorial claims and are all plotting wars against each other and need weapons. But Zaharoff realized that you never just go in and sell weapons, let's say, to the Greeks. You sell weapons to all the people the Greeks might fight. And if there's a war, you make the most money by arming both sides of the conflict. And that becomes the model, which certainly, you know, if you're, again, selling weapons and munitions, this is what you want. The story, it's probably not true, but it's a story that's used to illustrate his methods. One idea is he went to the Greeks and he sold them a submarine. And then, having finished that, he goes to the Turks in Constantinople and goes, I just sold the Greeks a submarine. I'll make a special deal if you buy two.
Hey, hold it there. We got a break coming up at the bottom of the hour.
All right.
The prelude to World War One, which leads to World War Two, which leads to, well, the current situation in the Middle East. So let us take the break. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Dr. Richard Spence. We shall return. And we are back. My guest this morning is Dr. Richard Spence, and we're discussing the events prior to World War One and an arms merchant named Basil Zaharoff. And you know, Rick, it really sounds almost like history does repeat itself in terms at least of patterns.
Well, it repeats itself. Another way to put it is that it's the same play that's constantly rehearsed in different dress. You change the costumes, you change the names of the characters, but it's the same play, and it's always being put on. Yeah, it's people do learn. They don't learn fast.
Apparently not.
They don't necessarily learn what they're supposed. Sometimes they learn what you wouldn't expect them to do. But it's So, yeah, Zaharoff is a... I think I wrote an article about him once, and I started it off by saying is that, well, you know, whether if there is such a thing as the Illuminati, then this guy was definitely part of it. If he wasn't, then certainly they wouldn't be doing their job. You know, he's also known as the mystery. Zaharoff was a man who exercised from this period, especially during the First World War on Allied governments and later on, exercised a tremendous amount of influence behind the scenes. But keep in mind, he's never a politician. He never holds any kind of government position. But because of his wealth, because of his influence, he lives well into the 1930s. Mm. No one can tell you exactly where or when he is born.
Hmm.
He made up a kind of past for himself.
He takes a great picture.
Yes, and he's, you know, he looks appropriately sinister as
Doesn't
well.
Doesn't he?
But again, he was very secretive, burned all of his personal papers before his death. One of the other things that he acquired in the 1920s is he basically bought the country of Monaco. I mean, you know, Monaco had its prince, but Zaharoff essentially owned the casino. So you've heard about the man who broke the bank at Monte Carlo.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Zaharoff bought the casino at Monte Carlo. That was his little personal kingdom, in a way. He was technically a French citizen, although he was never born there. He managed to buy his way into getting French citizenship. But he was also owned a knighthood from the British. So he's Sir Basil Zaharoff.
Hmm.
And this made some of the French suspicious of him. This made some people in Britain suspicious of him. But he was a kind of indispensable, you know, the term eminence grise, the sort of gray eminence behind the scene.
And supplying arms to every side
supplying
possible.
Supplying arms. And the thing is that there are people in and around. Well, there are two other people in Constantinople in that pre-war period who are connected to each other through him, because both of them worked for Zaharoff as arms salesmen in this period. One of them is a very peculiar character, which I can't do justice to, you know, in a real description, by the name of Ignatius Trebitch Lincoln.
Oh, yeah, he's our picture number 8.
Yes, and Ignatius Trebitch Lincoln was born Ignatz Trebitch in Hungary. He was born into a Hungarian Jewish family. He repudiated his family and his religion. He became an Anglican. He actually becomes an Anglican priest, goes on a mission to Canada. At some point, by an amazing situation, managed to actually get him elected as a member to the British Parliament.
What?
And a naturalized British subject. But the other thing is that he works for this time. He's involved in all his companies. He's a schemer, right? So where Zaharoff is sort of at the upper end of this conspiratorial pyramid,
mm-hmm.
if you want to think of it that way, Trebitch Lincoln is always sort of down somewhere in the middle. He always seemed to be sort of, he never becomes particularly wealthy or successful. In fact, much of his life appears to be a kind of failure. But he crosses paths with Zaharoff in this period. And the other thing is that Trebitch Lincoln shows up in Germany right after World War One. You know, the same period we were talking about, the Thule Society and
mm-hmm.
the Botendorf who was there, and starts interacting with the same group of people. Trebitch Lincoln becomes associated with a group of what were then sort of embittered right-wing army officers who actually make an attempt to overthrow the German government in 1920. So he's involved in this counter-revolutionary sort of proto-fascist plot.
Kind of a similar situation to the Ba'athist generals who are now behind ISIS after being thrown out of, our war on Saddam.
And he's actually their press secretary.
Uh-huh.
And some of these people later find their way into the Nazi movement. I mean, all of these people are sort of moving in and around each other. And
so would you say that Trebitch Lincoln was kind of like a fixer, kind of like a Ray Donovan character?
Well, there are two ways to look at him. I'm not sure they're mutually exclusive. One is that he's just a kind of, he's a would-be intriguer and spy who's really more a bumbler, and he basically screws things up and fails.
Oh.
The other is that he's someone who appears, but what he does is that when he shows up, things tend to go wrong with whatever group he's associated with. And one way to read that is that that's what his job was, that he appears to be assisting. Now, that in this case of the so-called cop putsch is what it's called, K-A-P-P, in 1920. Again, it was this right-wing attempt to seize control of the Weimar government. It fails. It actually takes control of Berlin for a couple of days. But one accusation is that what his job was there was to ensure its failure. That at, while appearing to assist them, he's actually working against them. And this is even later what some of his comrades at the time later said. They weren't really sure what side he was on. And you can't tell about him. On the one hand, while this is going on, he's in contact with Soviet, with Bolshevik agents in Berlin. So there were people who believed that he was actually working for the Bolsheviks. There are other Germans who think that, no, he's actually working for the British. There are people among the British that think that he's working for the Bolsheviks or the Germans, or they're not sure who. He ends his life, by the way, in China as a Buddhist monk.
China?
I'm not kidding you. He goes to China in the 1920s, where he sells weapons to Chinese warlords, and then becomes their political advisor. By the way, everybody he becomes a political advisor to fails. And then he becomes converted to Buddhism, changes his name to the Abbot Chao Kung, forms his own Buddhist sect, complete with nuns, by the way, and then stays there, and he dies in China in the Japanese-occupied zone, collaborating with the Japanese in 1943. His great unfulfilled ambition was to reach Tibet.
Shambhala.
Shambhala, yes. And there's that kind of, and he thought that somehow that Tibet was this, you know, not just to see the Dalai Lama, but that he thought there were these other mystics that he could make contact with there. And, you know, again, Friedrich Lincoln can be viewed as a kind of almost sort of comic opera spy and a kind of failure. I don't quite see him that
unless
way.
He was incredibly adept, and he appeared to be incompetent, but he was incredibly competent.
Or that is that his incompetency was actually him succeeding at what his primary mission was. And yet another person who is in Constantinople at the same time in these years before the war and was also involved in arms dealing was a guy by the name of Alexander Helphand. And
okay, he's our image number 7 under Radio with Pictures tonight.
He's also known as Parvis. He wrote into that. Alexander Helphand was born in Russia. He became a Marxist revolutionary, left Tsarist Russia. Now, this is when the Tsar was in control. Went to Germany, joined the Socialist Party there, and was apparently a fairly important figure in sort of developing Marxist and socialist ideology. But then, and this isn't that strange for Marxist revolutionaries, by the way, turns out he was a good businessman. And so one of the things that he manages to do in these pre-war years in Constantinople, dealing arms and timber and other things in this this center of intrigue, was to make himself a millionaire. He becomes quite wealthy. So he's rich. And then, again, when the war breaks out, he goes back to Germany, and he sells, he approaches the German high command, which is now at war with Britain and France and Russia, with Tsarist Russia. And he goes, look, Tsarist Russia is a kind of house of cards. There's a lot of discontent with the regime, and there's a revolutionary movement there. There are lots of revolutionaries that want to overthrow the Tsar, but what they need is money. So he goes, you, the Germans, give me money. I will channel it to these revolutionary groups and dissident nationalists, and I will overthrow Russia and remove your entire Eastern Front. You just have to give me enough money, and I will use that to engineer a revolution in Russia. And that is what he does. The most important and maybe unheralded figure in the Russian Revolution is not Lenin, it's not Trotsky, it's certainly not Stalin, it's Alexander Helpand.
Fascinating.
He is the mastermind of the whole thing.
Again, behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes. One of the things is that although he helps put Lenin and the Bolsheviks in power and expects Lenin to, you know, kind of be grateful for that, Lenin wants nothing to do with him and won't let him in the country. Because I don't want the revolution connected to dirty hands. What Lenin's referring to is that he didn't want, you know, if he brought in Helpand, it would be too obvious to the connection with the Germans, which is something that Lenin and the entire regime wanted to obscure.
Are you struck by the alliteration of the names Helpand?
Well, yeah, it's actually the anglicized. His real name is Gelfand, G-E-L-F-A-N-D.
Ah, okay.
That's what the original name was. Then somehow in Germany, that gets changed to Helpand, which is still not a German term.
See,
it's an anglicized name.
One of the things I've been noticing over a long period of time is you have these resonances, and I don't know what else to call them. But for instance, during the Gulf War, you know, was prosecuted by General Schwarzkopf, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which means General Blackhead, who was fighting the Iraqis, who were, you know, the black-headed people, et cetera.
It's, you know, it's one of those things that you can say it's a kind of interesting coincidence, or it's not. I'm always a believer in the idea that genuine coincidences are very rare.
Hmm.
Generally, if it looks like it's a coincidence, it isn't one.
Well, you remember what the gray man said in X-Files? You know, in terms of predicting the future, we found the best way is to control it.
Yeah. Well, if nothing else, people like Zaharoff and even Trebitch Lincoln in his less dramatic way, and Helpand, I mean, you've got this one spot in the world, and at a certain number of years, these people who actually are playing important roles behind, never as prime ministers, never as generals, never as any kind of visible political influence, but influential nonetheless, people who instigate revolutions, who plan them, who fund them, who instigate, fund, and supply wars.
Right out of what people think of as the Illuminati handbook.
Well, you know, if there certainly could have been. I mean, whether or not they're organized into a club, individually they're there, and they often seem to connect to
each other. But a lot of these people knew each other, and they all crossed in Constantinople.
Yeah, and see, that's the intriguing question. They're all there. They're sort of working. You know, you can find one working for them. How closely did they actually cooperate? And that's one of those things that I certainly, you know, want to know more about. I think it's something that, you know, any curious person ought to want to know more about. There's a connection, but then it's a different thing to define how far does that connection go. How far back does it go? How far forward does it go? How closely are these people just working together?
Here's a weird speculative idea. If the Utah group, you know, were actually talking to somebody upstairs with more power, more knowledge, whatever, who was a distant member of the human family, looking down on their poor cousins and trying to intervene those guys in a positive way, who's to say you don't have another faction of the guys upstairs? And again, we're not talking aliens, we're talking humans in a much larger context, much longer view of history, tens and not hundreds of thousands of years. Who's to say you don't have another faction that's intervening to try to really screw things up?
Well, if nothing else, that sort of fits the universal law of symmetry, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You have one side, you have to have another one.
Dark forces, light forces.
Light forces, left. Right, you know, there has to be this kind of, that if something exists, you know, you can say it's the old thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
Mm-hmm. Very Hegelian.
Every thesis will beget an antithesis, and that in some way through their struggle, they will then create a synthesis, and that creates a new thesis, and then there will be a new antithesis to oppose it, and so on and so on and so on, sort of ad infinitum.
It sure is a direct line from these machinations to the chaos and the abysmal horror going on in the Middle East right now with 4 million refugees trying to get out of Syria.
Well, it's, you know, one of the results of, like, can either be miscalculation or the results of plotting, if you will, is that millions of people die.
Yeah.
And that's maybe one of the sobering things to keep in mind, is that if there are the adepts and wherever they come from, members of the human community or not, they may be well-intentioned or they may not be, but, you know, in some cases, even to achieve what they might consider to be a useful goal, a certain number of human beings might need to die. We might need to create chaos out of which we can create a new order. Or maybe the whole point is simply to generate constant chaos and never achieve order.
Hmm.
Well, you know, to get this argument that chaos is creative. Things happen, you know, if everything is peaceful and stable and everything is in balance, well, nothing happens.
Well, to get progress, you've got to have energy differentials, and the way you do that in human relationships is you have conflict.
You have conflict. You know, one of the things you can argue is that wars are destructive, but wars also force a great deal of innovation.
Well, look at the Cold War, look at the, you know, World War II leading to the Cold War. So we got all these conspirators milling around Constantinople. We still haven't got ourselves to the beginning of World War II and the Nazis.
Well, it's, you know, another figure we could throw in here, and this would have to be the future discussion, since I don't think in 10 minutes we can
No, we can't do it in 10 minutes.
Is I assume that certainly you and many of your listeners have heard of Aleister Crowley.
Of course.
Okay. And Aleister Crowley is one of the, I would want to put in here, I always have to put this as a disclaimer, I am not a member of Aleister Crowley's religious doctrine. I'm not a member of his organization. I am not a believer. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily a disbeliever, but I don't approach him from that standpoint. He's not a substitute Jesus to me, or whatever it may be to some people. I'm not interested in him in that way. I became interested in him because, again, doing research on another topic and sending off for a file about him in New York during it, Aleister Crowley spent all of World War I in New York.
Hmm.
Right? From 1914 to 1919, he is in New York.
I thought he was in Britain, but obviously I'm wrong.
No, he was not there. And in fact, that was one of the problems, because it was argued, one, that he deserted his country during wartime, and worse than that, there was definite proof that in New York, he had written anti-British propaganda for a pro-German publication. In fact, a magazine called The Fatherland. All right? Don't get much more German title than that.
Nope.
And he did. He came over.
Unless you want to call it The Homeland.
we'll appreciate this. He came to the U.S. soon after the war began. He came to New York on October 31st aboard the Lusitania.
Halloween.
So he arrived. I'm not sure whether he planned it that way, but he came and he remained.
Oh, he must have planned it that way. Come on.
Well,
come on.
I don't know. You know, maybe the ship sailed once a month. I mean, it's one of those things that could be a coincidence, but I don't think.
Not if you're looking at those mysterious forces and all that, because there is backing to the idea of that date is important.
I think he appreciated it, if nothing else. And he stays there until he goes back to Britain at the end of 1919. So he's in the U.S. and mostly in New York for the whole war. Now remember, it's very clear, and he admitted the fact that, yes, I wrote anti-British articles for the Fatherland, but his claim thereafter was always that I did this actually in service to Britain. I was actually an agent for the British government during the war, and everything that I did that appeared to be treasonous and anti-British was actually done with the approval of higher-ups in London.
Hmm.
Now, that's one of those things that even supporters of Kroll, even those people who believed everything else he said, tended to doubt. They thought that this was just kind of self-serving explanation.
And there was never any corroboration from the Admiralty?
There was never any corroboration until I sent off for a little file. There was another investigative agency that no longer exists called the Military Intelligence Division. That actually was run by the U.S. Army.
Hmm.
And that was, in the First World War, was more important than the Bureau of Investigation in terms of sort of internal security.
Really?
So what happened is that there was an investigation of Aleister Crowley begun by the MID in 1918 because they were aware that he had been associating with known German agents and that he had written anti-British propaganda, and they thought he was a very peculiar character. So what it came down to is that they were planning on rounding him up because they thought he was a pro-German. And there was an inquiry made to the British consulate in New York about this guy. And I'm going to read from you from the report of MID Major James B. Ord in terms of the reply that he received from the consulate. And he says that... They're talking about Crowley here, has been formally investigated by the Department of Justice on charges of being a German spy. It was determined that Aleister Crowley was an employee of the British government, but at present in this country on official business of which the British consul, New York City, has full cognizance.
Hmm.
The British government was fully aware of the fact that Crowley was connected with this German propaganda and had received money for writing anti-British articles.
So he was an agent.
So he was.
For the Brits. Kind of like Leon Bone being an inside guy in the cult in Utah.
So what it meant, and what was important to me about this, is it meant that, well, you know, Aleister Crowley in this case was kind of telling the truth. I mean, whatever he must have done otherwise, when he said that he was working for the British government... He was working for the British government.
Okay, we only got 2 minutes left. Do you know of the connection between Aleister Crowley and the U.S. space program, NASA?
Doesn't have anything to do with Montauk, does it?
Not at all. Nope.
Okay, well, tell me.
Has to do with JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
With, yes, of course.
With Jack Parsons.
Jack Parsons' lab. There we go.
Yep.
Yes. John Whiteside Parsons, who becomes a Thelemite, one of Crowley's followers in the 1940s, and then blows himself up in the 1950s, and who was
was blown up because he was involved in things that maybe some Jewish folks didn't like, and working with Germans and all that. One does
not
know
that, but then there's also one story that he had a job offer in Israel.
Yeah.
He also was accused of being a communist.
Yes.
He did associate with communists and was sort of involved, if not... Well, one of the things that Parsons did in one occasion, he took classified documents home.
Mm-hmm.
That's what got him fired, I think, from one of his jobs. And, you know, he said it was just kind of an oversight, but then...
There was a recent national security director who also did the same thing, who got off with a tap on the wrist.
You know, it's surprising how many people do that, you know, just kind of wander off with some secret documents and weren't quite aware they had them at the time.
Rick, we're out of time.
Okay.
I know. We got to have more time. Look, you will come back, I presume you will come back, because we have tons more stories.
I'd be thrilled to.
I have appreciated this immensely. I know our audience has. You only cracked the door. So again, everyone, another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. So, until tomorrow, same time, same channel, this is Richard C. Hoagland saying to you, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning.